I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
And welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And we're going to talk today about the siege of Moscow and about how the Wehrmacht, the German army, failed in the snows of the Russian winter and what this meant for Hitler's plans to conquer the Soviet Union. By the autumn of 1941, the news for the Allied powers, at this point really Great Britain and the Soviet Union, America had not yet entered the war, but obviously had a vested interest in its outcome, the news was unremittingly bad. From 1940 through to mid-1941, there had been nothing but victories for Nazi Germany. Italy had, of course, suffered significant setbacks in the desert, but had been helped by the Germans to push the British all the way back, eventually, to the borders of Egypt. And the problem that Hitler has on invading the Soviet Union is that things don't go to plan, things don't work to timescale, and the way in which Germany has traditionally waged war has been, you know, very time sensitive. That Germany, from the 1870s onwards, has waged quick lightning wars that need to be concluded rapidly, largely due to resources. And most countries probably have fought war in roughly similar ways. Both Great Britain and Russia have far greater capacity to bed down for the long term and to wear the enemy down. And Russia's vast size, Russia's inclement weather, and Russia's enormous population are three things that make it, to all intents and purposes, virtually unconquerable. However, the chaos within the Red Army and the problems that Stalin had created for himself gave Hitler every chance that a victory might have been possible. In November 1941, Konstantin Rokossovsky, one of the most successful of Stalin's generals, throughout the Second World War, who was in command of the 16th Army north of Moscow, told journalists, "Soon the Germans will start to get washed out, and the time will come, will be in Berlin." Now, this might have been mistaken for being hyperbole at the time, or hyperbole, I beg your pardon. The Germans had so far been extremely successful in almost every campaign they'd fought in Russia up to that point. But Rokossovsky seemed to know more about the terrain and the weather than probably the Wehrmacht did. And the turning of the weather saves Moscow. On November the 17th, for example, a division of the Wehrmacht broke and fled in the face of a new tank that had been placed against them by the Soviets, the T-34. These were cold weather vehicles with broad tracks and low centres of gravity, low chassis, that could manage the rough terrain of the Soviet Union. They were manoeuvrable, they were fast, they had large guns, and they didn't freeze up. At this time as well, Stalin's Siberian divisions were being moved away from facing the possible threat of Japan all the way back down the Trans-Siberian Railway to the Moscow theatre. Max Hastings quotes an SS officer saying, "Thus we are approaching our final goal, Moscow, step by step. It is icy cold. The start of the vehicle engines. They must be warmed by lighting fires under the oil pan. The fuel is partially frozen. The motor oil is thick, and we lack antifreeze. The remaining limited combat strength of the troops diminishes further due to the continuous exposure to the cold. The automatic weapons often fail to operate because the breech blocks can no longer move." Now, there's a significant portion of Richard J. Evans' The Third Reich at War, which explains why this had come about. The image that we have of German rearmament, of factories churning out artillery shells in propaganda films, is very far from the actual reality. There was huge rearmament, but vast amounts of institutional chaos. It's possible to make umpteen numbers of tanks, but if you don't put antifreeze in the fuel, they're all largely useless. So the Reich plenipotentiary for the four-year plan, Hermann Göring, a man who incompetence seems to follow him around like an albatross, was part of the explanation for this. But the rationalisation and the reorganisation of the German war industry only comes with Albert Speer. Now, Albert Speer replaces the German armaments minister Fritz Todt, who died in a mysterious plane crash roughly about the time that we're talking about, roughly about the time of the siege of Moscow. And when Speer finds his does an audit of munitions factories, he finds the following things. He finds factories that are empty, factories where there are no workers, factories where things that are completely unnecessary are being produced. He finds too many different kinds of tank, aircraft, lorry and jeep being produced, and very little central coordination of what is needed in terms of industrial output. So there's a great deal of chaos. And we know that looking at the Third Reich very carefully, and if you listen to the podcast I've done on the workings of Hitler's government, then this comes up, that it does work on chaos, and that the Führerprinzip, the Führer principle, is one that kind of sweeps bureaucratism to one side. Well, the reason why we have bureaucratism isn't to create problems for ourselves. Governments have bureaucrats because, by and large, bureaucracy produces results, even though most people are kind of loath to say such a thing. And the other reason why the German army was stuck in the snows of Russia and unable to seize Moscow was that the timetable for capture of the Soviet Union starts to come unpicked very, very soon after the invasion. Not only is it Hitler's interference that starts to divert armies to unnecessary goals, but also the fact that the Russians don't simply evaporate and disappear, and that the German army isn't completely successful in all its objectives. The Russians are much harder opponents than the Germans had accounted for or bargained for. And this again shows us that any policy that is informed by racial thinking is one that is almost destined to be wildly misinformed. German soldiers suffered, of course, from frostbite, dysentery, and one single regiment of 1,000 men lost a third of its soldiers due to frostbite alone. And this is even before fighting has begun. On the 3rd of December, General Hoepner, who commanded the 4th Panzer Group, said, "The offensive combat power of the corps has run out. Reasons: physical and moral overexertion, loss of a large number of commanders, inadequate winter equipment. The high command should decide whether a withdrawal should be undertaken." So this was one of Hitler's many red lines, that German soldiers do not withdraw. The reality is that most skilled and intelligent commanders in the field understood that strategic withdrawals were an essential part of warfare. They're how armies have to operate from time to time. And it is not an admittance of defeat or cowardice. It is what armies have to do in order to re-maneuver and regroup. Hitler based his ideas about withdrawal on racial principles, that the German soldier must and should stand and fight, and that in doing so there would be many sacrifices and many martyrs, but this sacrifice and martyrdom was innate to Nazism itself. And it seems that when Nazism really gets into the field, and when Nazism is pitched against significant odds, that it isn't an ideology that stands the test of time. I mean, no matter how odious and offensive most right-thinking people would find Nazism, the fact that it crumbles actually when faced with realistic challenges to an ideological picture is something really quite telling. One of the things that the debacle outside Moscow does is it proves to demoralised Russian soldiers that the Germans can be beaten. In the first few days of the Russian counterattack, there are significant advances, significant victories over the Germans. One Russian soldier is quoted as feeling relief and happiness swept through our ranks. The Germans did not seem so terrible now. They could be beaten. This doesn't suggest that the tactics used by the Russians were very much better than the Germans. The Red Army still was operating on a mass basis, so throwing troops at the enemy in as large numbers as.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Possible. These were frontal assaults, and they were launched at Stalin's word. Just like Hitler, Stalin demanded that there be not one step back, no more tactical retreats. Stalin, more than anything, was determined to shore up his own political position, one which by the summer of 1941 had become very vulnerable and exposed, and the doctrine of preventing any kind of retreats was one that was essential in his eyes to at least winning the propaganda war against the Nazis, but against any potential detractors within the party. German intelligence seems to have been particularly poor. On the 4th of December, the German army intelligence concluded that the Russian army, the Red Army, was incapable of launching any further counter-offensives. The fact that Zhukov had been sent 9 new armies, 27 divisions, and more horse-backed, more cavalry units had been raised, which could, cavalry in heavy snow is actually quite handy, and horses can make it through snowdrifts where vehicles can't go. That this was completely lost on German intelligence. By the time that the German offensive had ground to a halt, the German army was 25 miles from the Kremlin and 9 miles from the outskirts of Moscow. However, the loss of 200,000 soldiers since the beginning of the offensive meant that, and the end of the fighting capacity of the German army due to cold, meant that there was very little else that could be achieved. The counteroffensive came on the 5th of December. The Russians launched an enormous surprise attack, which meant that the Germans had little capability of defending against. The German army was utterly frozen, quite literally. And at this point, the temperature was 30 degrees below Celsius. And the benefits of antifreeze in Russian tanks were essential to winning this particular campaign. One German infantryman describes it as this: out of the snow, storm soldiers were running back, scattering in all directions like a panic-stricken herd of animals. A lone officer stood against this desperate mass. He gesticulated, trying to pull out his pistol, and then simply let it pass. Our platoon commander made no attempt at all to stop people. I paused, wondering what to do, and there was an explosion right next to me, and I felt a searing pain in my right thigh. I thought, I'm going to die here, 21 years old, in the snow before Moscow. It was the first full retreat of the German army in over 2 years of war in Europe. And as the German army retreated, it used the same scorched earth tactics as the Soviet Union did as it retreated earlier in the year, burning villages as they went, denying the Russians any kind of shelter, and obviously killing as many Soviet citizens as they could along the way. One officer wrote about conditions at a field dressing station. 80 men were brought here today, half of whom have second or third degree frostbite. Their swollen legs are covered in blisters and they no longer resemble limbs. but rather some formless mass. In some cases, gangrene has already set in. What is it all for? Many German soldiers considered Napoleon's quest into Russia in 1812 and saw distinct parallels between his failure to conquer Russia. Napoleon actually did manage to seize Moscow, and then the city burned and resulted in his humiliating winter retreat from Russia, which completely destroyed the Grand Army. The Wehrmacht retreat lasted for 10 days. The destruction that German soldiers marched through was immense. It was the ruins, really, of much of Hitler's visions for the conquest of the Soviet Union. And his general plan, Ost, the hunger plan that he planned to inflict on the Soviet Union, and the colonisation that he hoped would happen fairly swiftly following the defeat of the Red Army. Hitler demanded fanatical resistance. He wanted German soldiers to fight to the death. Much of what Hitler sees happening on the battlefield is part of is something from his own imagination, something from his own kind of memories of fighting in the First World War, perhaps misremembered recollections of fighting in the First World War and projected onto what he thinks should happen. Again, in Richard J. Evans, one of the things that he points out is that Hitler's life before 1939 had been rather indolent and idle and carefree. He had lived as a dictator, doing very little, so rather kind of dilettantish sort of existence. And he has to work extremely hard as a war leader, particularly one who wants to micromanage the conduct of the war in such detail. And the pressures by 1943 have really taken their toll on him physically. Speer recalls meeting Hitler after not seeing him for a while and seeing this kind of diminished grade, much kind of weaker individual with kind of a permanent shake in his hand. It's possible that Hitler was in the first stages of Parkinson's disease during the Second World War. The German position in Russia is only saved by the mistakes that the Soviets make, particularly the mistakes that Stalin makes. The misuse of troops, the waste of troops, and the micromanagement that Stalin has over the Red Army means that opportunities to break through the German line at the weakest point are lost, and that the Soviet counterattack eventually runs out of steam. So this allows the German line to stabilise itself and to recover some of the lost ground. It also means that the encirclement of the whole of Army Group Centre, which is what Zhukov wanted to do, is not possible. And once again, this is really more to do with Stalin's meddling than anything else. One of the key changes in the war on the Eastern Front comes in 1942-43, when Stalin finally decides to allow his generals the leeway to do what they need to do. Hitler never accepts this. When Stalin did that, military professionals in the field were able to win battles consistently, but of course it put generals like Zhukov in Stalin's crosshairs after the end of the war. Stalin believed that Zhukov had got too big for his boots and saw Zhukov as a threat to his own position and prestige, and became extremely vindictive and threatening towards Zhukov. And the whole focus of Stalin's internal policies from the late 1940s onwards was to try to reassert control, the kind of dictatorial control he had in the 1930s, back on a Russia, which parts of which had had to become semi-autonomous as a result of the war. One part that obviously became almost completely autonomous was, of course, Leningrad, which we'll look at in the next podcast on Russia. By the end of the failure of Operation Typhoon, the attempt to seize Moscow, the Russians were still in control of the city, and the Germans had been pushed back, in some cases, up to 150 miles. So it had been a catastrophic failure, the first catastrophic failure of the war, and the first piece of welcome news that the Allied powers had heard. Okay, so I'll finish that, and we're going to look at, as I said, Leningrad next time we delve into the war in Russia. I hope you find this useful. If you can, check out our Patreon page. We're always in need of good patrons here. And there's some original journalism and writing and ideas there that no doubt you'll find interesting, or hopefully anyway. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.